Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Normally on this podcast, we are discussing healthcare roles, science, immunological issues, or some kind of disease process. But today I have a different topic. It's actually a very special topic, especially this time of year, as it affects so many, and it truly does have an effect on health and healthcare in the long run. Today I am joined by Abigail Henrich. Abby is the dual pastor and co-founder of Grace Community in Boston, Massachusetts. She is also the pastor at Stratford Street United Church in West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Abby is a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary and Colgate University. She is also the co-host of the Progressive Sacred podcast, where she and her fellow hosts discuss topics from science and religion, women and the clergy, to progressive takes on Christmas and Easter. Abby has been at the forefront of promoting progressive Christianity, which is characterized by a willingness to question tradition, accept human diversity, including religious diversity, seek social justice, care for the poor and oppressed, tend to the environment, and gather as a community in new ways. Her efforts at Grace Community have helped to feed the homeless, host gun buybacks, allocate goods to help underserved communities here and abroad, as well as promote the spirit of inclusion, kindness, love, and joy. Abby is also the pastor at Stratford Street United Church, a progressive Protestant church which is home to Rose's Bounty. Rose's Bounty is a food pantry located here in West Roxbury area of Boston, Massachusetts, and she is here today to discuss a topic of food insecurity, who it affects, why it's a growing concern, and how we can help to provide nutritious food for those in need, especially this time of the year. Abby, thank you so much for joining.
It's great to be here with you, Andy.
So Abby, we'll kind of get started here and talk a little bit about food insecurity. I think a lot of people kind of have a misconception of what it is. Just to start, back in 2023, there were 47 million Americans who lived in food insecure households, and that's about one in seven households just in the United States. This includes about 14 million children and an additional 12.2 million adults who live in households with very low food security. So I think a lot of people have the misconception of what food insecurity means. And it's not necessarily the inability to obtain food or that someone's starving from lack of food, but a lot of times it's something different, more about the quality of food you can get. Is that correct? And maybe you can help explain a little bit more.
Absolutely. So at Rose's Bounty, where we unload, I just have to make sure this is clear to everybody because we're the coolest. We unload over 12,000 pounds of food a week. When you think about nutritious food, it's heavy. It really is. It's dense. So let me give you some examples of some food that we unload. Nuts, like huge pound bags of walnuts, or carrots and potatoes and onions, and how heavy those are. The less nutritious food that we unload is really light. It's Cheerios, some fun packaged cookies for kids. And those things are important to give to families too, because we want kids happy who come to Rose's Bounty. But to obtain a bag of nuts, which caloric intake is so high and they're so nutritious for you in healthy fats, costs three times as much as it would to buy a bag of corn chips, let's say. And I hope listeners out there, you know that you probably want to eat the bag of nuts over corn chips if you don't have enough nutrition. But then it even gets more complicated. So right, that right there shows a sign of food security or insecurity. That shows you, that's a really good example of food security and food insecurity. It's difficult actually at a corner store to get a huge bag of nuts that, I mean, you could go to Costco, right? But you got to be able to drive to Costco, get there, get the bag, huge bag of nuts, have a Costco membership. That's really nutritious, but it's a lot easier to get the bag of corn chips.
And even at the corner store, most of the nuts in there, they're going to be very high in salt, sugar,
yes,
full of preservatives. Like it's a less healthy alternative than just a plain raw nut.
Without question. And so I guess what I'm trying to explain is food insecurity has a lot of different levels. It has a level of access to food, to healthy food. Can you get to Costco? Or are you just able to get to the corner store? What can you afford? Because healthy food often costs much more. Just its density, right? I was talking about its density, its heaviness. That the healthiest food is often most dense. Costs more too. Costs a lot more to buy a bag of carrots, again, than it does corn chips. Also, preparation of food is another part that moves into food insecurity. So one of the things, this is just anecdotal piece of information that was pretty powerful, is when we first started working with a group of children who were food insecure at the Chittick School, we realized that we had to send home can openers. Not everybody had can openers. And then we had to start thinking about what food can these children prepare in a microwave. And so that these are many and multiple complicated levels around who has access to healthy food, who can afford healthy food, how do they prepare healthy food. These are the things that are really complicated for lots of families and individuals in America.
So it's really multifactorial. It's not just the fact that people can't access, you know, not just food itself, but it's getting healthier food, being able to prepare the healthy food, probably knowing how to prepare the healthy food.
Yes.
Which is just, and do you have any idea like how to even solve those problems? Or
no, but we've got some, I think all good community leaders and good nonprofits will tell you we have no idea, but we're trying. So one of the things that I think the school program is a really good example. So some of the families are really, really open to trying to learn. Or maybe a kid is doubling up at their aunt's house. That's what we call it. A lot of children aren't necessarily homeless without a home in the sense of they do not have a place to live, but they are couch surfing or doubling up. And so sometimes they'll get in situations and they might be living with an auntie or a grandma or, you know, a next door neighbor who's willing to help them learn. And so we've been sending home with these kids, kids in the kitchen. And so every week, our food pantry director and some other folks, depending on who's in charge that week, come up with 5 to 7 basic ingredients that we can send the kids home with that they learn how to prepare and make a fairly healthy meal. And I say fairly because I'm a mother and I know kids don't always want to eat all healthy. So we try to make it something they want to eat too, but it's pretty healthy and nutritious. And the hope is that they'll start building that skill of learning how to cook healthy food and discovering, wow, it didn't take long and this was really good.
It's home cooking is always better than something you're going to buy at the store, depending on who prepares it.
Yes.
When I was growing up in school, you had the option, and often, I don't know how they do it now, but you would have a home economics course, mm-hmm. and they would actually teach you some of the basics of cooking. They teach you, you know, how to make a basic sauce or even biscuits or something just generalized. I have no idea if those programs still exist in schools anymore.
There are very few of those programs. Yeah. Very, very few of those programs. And so a lot of those skills are being lost, and we need to fight food insecurity. People also need to become educated about food. That's another thing that we face. So I'll never forget. So just so folks know how a food pantry works, we're a part of the Greater Boston Food Pantry. And let's say that the farmers in the Midwest have a bumper crop of celery. We don't want the farmers to lose money. So the government buys that celery and distributes it to food pantries all over the country. And then we get to buy that celery for free. Now, there are some things that we buy from the food pantry, but at an incredible reduced price, but we may get, you know, you'll have a list of all the things that are free. So I'll never forget, there was some reason there was a bumper crop of celery, apparently. We get all these boxes of celery, and I love celery. I don't think you can start cooking without onions, garlic, and celery. That's what I learned at home.
Isn't that the French mirepoix? Isn't that the carrot, celery, and onion?
I don't know. Like that is true.
It's like the basic.
Yes. But the Pam Henrich cook in me, that's my mother. You start with onions, garlic, and celery.
Yeah. Can't go wrong.
Can't go wrong, right? And then, of course, celery is like great to put peanut butter in, you know, ants on a log, put some raisins on it, you know?
Now you're talking.
Nobody took the celery. Now, part of that was a cultural difference. Yeah. Part of it is that some of the folks who come to our food pantry, they've never cooked with celery. It's not native to where they grew up. They don't know about celery. Part of it is they had no idea what to do with it. So one of the things that the food pantry is really great at doing here at Rose's Bounty is if we get a kind of oddball fruit or vegetable, we label it. We put a Google link for it because a lot of folks still have cell phones and they can see. We put a recipe that goes with it. We do all of those things to try to help people or empower them to learn how to do it. Like when we get big squashes, we're like, no, really? Take home this winter squash. You'll love it. All you have to do is cut it in half. Put it in your oven. Bake it. We promise. If you think it isn't great, put a little brown sugar on it. We promise you, you'll like it. So that is another thing. It's about education and teaching people how to eat food.
Which is really helpful. And I think sometimes, I know that my grandmother kind of taught my aunts and uncles how to cook, and it's kind of passed down. Do you feel that as, you know, we're an aging population in the country anyway, we still have a lot of people coming in from other countries, and they're facing the same kind of thing with older population. Do you feel that less of that is being passed down?
Yes. Yes. I feel as if cooking in the home is no longer as much of a tradition. And I think it's a powerful tool in fighting insecurity. And in no way do I want any listener to think that I am placing judgment on people. I really don't want this to sound like a judgmental statement. But if I didn't have enough money to buy groceries, I would know to go buy lentils and carrots, and I could make a really healthy soup easily. But you need to learn how to do that. And if you haven't been taught how to do that, how do you know how to negotiate a grocery store for the best nutrition for the money you have? And if you don't have a grocery store near you, how do you do that? So do we want to talk about food deserts and what a food desert is?
I would love to, yeah. So I actually, I was reading somewhere, and I think it was in Detroit, that grocery stores, there was, for someone to get to a grocery store, they had to walk an average of, I think, a mile and a half mm-hmm. in some of their lower income communities. But they could go to the corner store at the 7-Eleven and get a hot dog and a Mountain Dew or whatever it is. But for them, and this is, I think, something else that people, we're thinking about food insecurity. A lot of us, you know, we have the convenience of driving to a grocery store, putting it in the car, driving it home. If you, you know, if you're a mother of three kids and you're trying to feed all those kids and you live in a neighborhood and you're a mile and a half away from a grocery store, 2 miles away, you don't have a vehicle. You can't afford to take an Uber or, you know, it used to be a taxi. Or, you know, you can't load that many groceries onto a bus. It's just hard to actually logistically get things from place to place. And I think that's where the conversation of food deserts comes up and where people can actually get healthy food. There's just fewer places, especially in some of these lower income communities.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to me. It's heartbreaking. And one of the things that gets me most excited about small grassroots organizations and communities fighting food insecurity is farmers markets. And that we are working really hard in the city of Boston, and I know other cities around the country, to bring farmers markets to food deserts and making it accessible. And amazingly, allowing people to use what we used to call food stamps. I still do. I don't know why I say that instead of, you know, your swipe card, but allowing people to use that money at farmers markets. And most farmers who go to farmers markets, small farmers, anything like that, they get thrilled about doing that work. Small farmers who are at farmers market, they get a great sense of purpose and joy from being able to show up in a place where there isn't easy access to healthy food. And I think that's one way we're making a huge difference. And zoning for grocery stores and demanding that grocery stores show up in neighborhoods.
Do you know, historically, have there been issues for grocery stores in certain neighborhoods to actually find areas for zoning? Really?
Yep. And I can give a really important example. In the city I grew up in, Buffalo, New York, there is a grocery store in the east side of Buffalo. It has now become a famous grocery store because a white supremacist went there and mowed down the shoppers there who are predominantly people of color. That grocery store shut down. I don't know the latest, and I should make sure that I look it up and see if Tops moved back in there. But not only did that make sure that that neighborhood wasn't a food desert, but it was a community hub. And one of the things that really breaks my heart is that that shooting, I hope if I owned that grocery store, that shooting would have I don't know, made me even more determined to keep a grocery store in that neighborhood. But instead, it was an easy out. And I think falsely, grocery store owners and chain owners will say things like, well, we don't make as big of a profit there. There's more crime. All these things that are really unfair that we always say and use as excuses in impoverished communities.
Yeah, which is kind of ridiculous when you think about it, because, I don't know, as a community too, they rely on that so much. You would think that as a grocer, you'd want to provide that service. But a lot of times it's, you know, in especially in larger, you know, cities, it's part of a hierarchy that, you know, those small stores are going to get shut down if somebody in corporate office in Des Moines, Iowa decides they don't want that store open.
Exactly. Which is, and that's really hard.
Which is why I love the idea of the farmers markets too. And yeah, there's no excuse, you know, nowadays for technology not being able to be used. Like, pretty much everybody's got a cell phone. Everybody can do Apple Pay. And pretty sure EBT cards, you can swipe anywhere, similar to a credit card.
Absolutely. It's great.
So I think that in of itself, too, just makes it that more accessible. Because, yeah, 20 years ago, you couldn't go to a farmer's market if you had, like, a paper food stamp.
And absolutely try and not. It would have been so hard. And it would have been so much work for those local farmers.
So we've kind of talked a lot about just kind of the communities that are really affected by the food insecurity. And there are specific groups who just seem more susceptible to the food insecurity. And I was wondering if you might be able to shed a little bit of light just on those groups in general.
Yes. So the primary groups are people with children, especially single parent households. I think that one probably registers with most people, right? If you're a single person and you don't have three other mouths to feed, you're probably going to be able to stretch your paycheck further, right? And single parent households we know tend to be more impoverished because there's one income earner. The other is the elderly population. That is another group of people who really face terrible food insecurity. And there are a lot of complicated reasons behind that. It's not just about fixed incomes and that they are a big population of low-income people in America, but they're also, their access and getting to food is really complicated, which is why the Meals on Wheels program has been unbelievably successful and an amazing movement in America. The other group are vets, veterans, and that's really hard. But as we know about veterans, they're susceptible to a lot of higher risk of all sorts of things. Yeah. Mental health, homelessness. It's really hard to swallow. But for me, actually, it's all of it's hard to swallow. I don't think there should be one child in America who is hungry. I can't stand it.
No, I don't think it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're, you know, a pastor or just somebody who is, you know, working, doing whatever. Like, I don't think anybody wants to see anybody go hungry.
No.
And we live in America. It's pretty much impossible to starve to death here, but there are people who can't actually get access to decent food.
Absolutely.
It's one of those things. One of my coworkers, we were talking about it, and she was saying that everybody should be, obviously, you should be able to get good, healthy food and just have, like, clean clothes.
Yes.
They don't have to be new, but you can yes. have, you know, clothes without holes that are dirty, shoes. Like, that's
yes.
something, especially in this country, that there's no reason why, you know.
Yes.
And thankfully, there are obviously places where we can provide that, but I think it's probably pretty hard, as you've seen, just the increase in the amount of people who actually need this kind of support, especially over the last, like, 4 years or so.
It's skyrocketed. And there's one other group that I didn't talk about, which has really broken my heart. Well, actually, there's another group that I haven't talked about, which I think is, I hope, obvious to folks, is immigrants and undocumented folks. And we can get back to that, because
sure.
I really like to talk to you about the immigrant yeah. population. But another group that needs to be highlighted, which I was so heartbroken by, but the number one factor, if you're a child in Boston, determining if you are food insecure or not, is if your parent is identifies as LGBTQ+. And that broke me, because I'm proud of living in a city that's incredibly inclusive, in a state that was the first to marry. I realize Vermont had civil unions, but we were the first to marry people. Proud of Massachusetts. But I was really distraught about that statistic.
Why do you think that is? Like, it's kind of, like, when you look at it, it's kind of an outlier almost, as far as when you would think who would be the most susceptible, and to have...
I really don't know. I do know that trans folks are some of the most underemployed people in the country. And so I wondered if that would relate. And I think the statistic is new enough that we don't really have answers. Yeah. But I was wondering, are LGBTQ plus folks just not getting jobs? Are they struggling with more mental health issues? Not, I want to make this clear, not because I think that people who are LGBTQ are mentally unwell, but because of the past trauma they have been through and being denied kind of embrace of who they were. I don't know.
I mean, depending where you live, current trauma too. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are still afraid to really identify with who they are, depending where they are. Massachusetts,
absolutely.
It's no problem. Chicago, you're doing okay. But if you're, you know, if you're in Texas, probably a little bit harder.
Yes.
If you're living in Boston.
Yes.
Which is definitely understandable. And yeah, if you have to, you know, kind of shovel money to other resources and it's going to prevent you from eating food, or if you can't find work for one reason or another, definitely see that. It'll be interesting, you know, over the next few years to kind of watch and see if data, if they're able to even find data that kind of gives a better explanation to why that is.
Yeah, I'm hoping that does not continue as a trend.
Rose's Bounty, as you were saying, it's a food pantry. It works with the Greater Boston Food Bank, helping those in need. How long has Rose's been in service?
Oh, Andy, why do you ask me number questions? I'm the worst.
Do you know?
Yes, I do, but I'm afraid I'm going to be fact-checked.
All right.
I believe we are now 9 years old. Okay. I do not believe we've hit our 10-year mark. It's an incredible story. I also think it's very much a bit of a Protestant story. So for all of you who grew up in Protestant churches out there, we believe in gaster evangelism. It means you shall feed them and they shall come, you know? Who cares about Jesus? It's all about that great dessert that that one lady who sits in the right pew makes, right? Or it's all about that fabulous casserole. I mean, my husband, who grew up in the Protestant church as a preacher's kid, still talks about Southern cooking that happened at potlucks in churches. Anyhow, so I think, you know, it's very Protestant to have gatherings around food. And there was a woman in this community, in this church, Rose Arntz, who was the hospitality queen. And she would put out fresh tablecloths every Sunday, because for those of you who haven't grown up in a Protestant church, coffee hour is totally normal. It has very little to do with coffee. It has to do with all the food that you eat with the coffee and the chitter chatter that happens, right? So Rose was a member of this church, and she would just put out a spread every week, like a full on spread, so that nobody needed to eat lunch. And lots of people helped, but she seemed to be the kind of major leader in that. When Rose died, her family gave a gift of money to the church. At the same time, this church was trying to decide who they really wanted to be, their kind of identity, and that they really felt called to do good, tangible work is the best way I can describe it in the community. At the same time, the West Roxbury Food Pantry was closing down because they lost their space. So those three things happened together, and Rose's Bounty was formed. And I think its name says a lot. It's not Rose's Food Pantry. It's Rose's Bounty. And I would say the thing that makes me incredibly proud about Rose's Bounty is it is a bounty of food that you get. And I think one of the reasons we have so many clients is because they leave with 2 loaded bags of non-perishable food, frozen meat, often multiple choices, cheese, eggs, an enormous box of produce. And when I say enormous, I'm saying the kids who volunteer cannot lift these boxes until they're in high school usually. These are big boxes of produce. And so it really is a bounty, and that bounty is extended. Now there's often dog food or cat food. There are diapers for seniors as well, which is important.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, and that's hard.
It's probably, it's
hard and embarrassing.
Yeah.
But no questions asked.
You need them,
and they're expensive. And then, you know, we can do fun stuff from time to time. Like in the summer months, right, a food pantry in this, I forget their name, but they salvage food, will bring, you know, fresh strawberries or a whole bunch of apples in the fall that maybe they got rejected because their skins aren't perfect, but they're delicious. And that's really fun to be able to do.
Yeah, I was going to ask one of the questions I had, because most people, I think, they have this kind of notion, at least I did before I actually volunteered in nursing school as part of the nursing program at a food pantry. Prior to that, I kind of had this conception that food pantries were just, you know, cans of beans and boxes of macaroni and cheese, and that was it. And so you kind of touched on that you have a protein available, so frozen meat, you have eggs, you have cheese, vegetables, fresh vegetables. I know that the pantry that I was at in nursing school, they would actually get, when grocery stores would have expired vegetables, because technically the expiration date, obviously they don't go bad the day it says they're expired, even though I tend to throw things out.
No, but like the lettuce that's going to go bad in 2 days that they need to move off their shelf, we get. The bread that's going to go bad in a day, we get.
Which is fantastic.
It's unbelievable.
Do you have any idea percentage-wise how much of like the goods that you give, how much of them are non-perishable compared to your, you know, I would say fresh or frozen?
I'm going to do it in like weight, which sounds kind of silly, but I know the weight that we have to load in. And I would say there is equal amount of calories that come in as non-perishable as in fresh.
Which is pretty crazy. It seems like a lot.
It's amazing. And that's why it takes a ridiculous number of volunteers to make this happen.
How big? So you mentioned that the prior West Roxbury pantry shut down because of the issue with the space, either they had to be moved or I'm not sure why. How much space do you guys have here? Because the church is, it's not a gigantic church.
But we have a gym.
I was going to ask. So I had actually seen where the pantry is. And you have like a walk-in. Is it a walk-in cooler?
We got everything.
Okay.
So because we started with a fairly big, like, I would say, think about it as a closet that would be the size of a small bedroom in a house. And, you know, we had two refrigerators in there, and then we had this amazing system of racks that we just pull out and pull back in. And we sort of created a grocery store and in the gym, and then we would get tables that day and load them with the fresh vegetables that came in that day that didn't need to be refrigerated. Like, think of carrots. They can be out for 2 days or whatever. And then we outgrew that. So then we took what used to be an old shower room, because in the 1950s, apparently they needed to shower at the gym at their church. Nobody apparently went home and showered then. And we made it like into a root cellar. The folks in the food pantry were really ingenious. They kind of sprayed the walls with insulation that made it a root cellar. Well, then we grew out of that, our four refrigerators and a root cellar. Then we got I think we now have 8 other freezer chests.
Wow.
Enormous freezer chest. Then we took over another room. Then we took over 2 more closets because, you know, you needed space for all the diapers and the baby food. Oh, and you need a special place for all the low sodium food. And how about the folks who have celiacs? And on it goes. So it's huge.
Which actually is a perfect kind of segue to my next question. So a lot of people so food insecurity in and of itself can lead to a lot of health issues for multiple reasons. One, you know, high fat, sodium content, sugar content. There's a huge uptick just in juvenile diabetes and diabetes in general. And what they're seeing now is a lot of people, especially with the cost of food right now, aren't able to actually buy medical supplies or take care of themselves. A lot of diabetics are foregoing buying, you know, diabetes supplies just so they can buy food. Do you, at Roses, you were saying you have low sodium. Do you guys oftentimes see people who come to you with certain health restrictions, and do you have enough goods to actually help provide for these people?
Not always, and yes. So this place is amazing, and our food pantry director is unbelievable. And she seems to be the yes woman. She has a will at all times to make things happen. So what's really great, and if you're out there and you know somebody who needs to go to a food pantry, make sure they develop a relationship with that food pantry. Because if somebody comes by one time, which we understand will happen, we're not going to do as good of a job as if we've seen you for the third time and we remember. Like a kid on the spectrum whose mom told me, it's really, really hard to get him to eat. And he's got a bunch of texture issues and stuff. And there is a cereal that kid loves. And listen, every time I see that cereal, I put it aside for that kid. And in the same way also, We know there's a client who came for a long time with celiacs. We always had that special stuff put aside for her. We have a bunch of elderly vets that we work with. We're always working on getting low sodium, low sugar. We're always working on that and putting those things aside. Because we can't do a perfect job, but we can try to do a better job.
What's pretty ridiculous, too, is when you're at the grocery store, a lot of times those foods that are low sugar, low sodium,
cost more.
They're more expensive.
Yeah.
Less ingredients. It's so ridiculous. It's such a, cost such more. A racket.
Cost more. And that, I mean, right? This is the crazy thing that we know happens all the time with social services in America. And that is that if we just invested up front, and you as a nurse know this, if we invested up front, things would be cheaper. In all social services. So if we invested upfront in healthy food, imagine, just imagine, if healthcare insurers helped offset the expensive cost of food for low-income folks or for folks who have special diets because they're diabetic or they have high blood pressure. Imagine if that was helped. We know that often insurance companies will pay for a child who's on formula, who needs to be on really expensive, complicated formula because they have lots of allergies. Well, imagine how much money it would save in the long run if people were eating well.
Yeah, and that's kind of another question I might have for you. So I know you said you provide beyond food, you also provide diapers, other things. Do you guys ever provide any kind of medical, even for diabetics, they need, you know, finger sticks or strips for blood glucometers or anything?
No, we don't. That's really an interesting thing. So we do try to provide some. So we'll get, for instance, we'll have this great skin doctor, actually nurse practitioner, skin nurse practitioner, whatever you call that, you medical people. I'm just a pastor.
Dermatology.
Yeah, there you go. She'll get tons and tons of samples of sunscreen. She always makes sure that we get them in May. We put them in all of our kids' bags, right? Teaching them about sunscreen, how important it is to do sunscreen. And so we try to do things like that, but food pantries are not allowed to give out medicine. Now, during COVID, we were supported and we were able to give out masks and we were able to give out COVID tests. But it seems really important that we would have some of those basic things too, wouldn't it?
I guess another question. So when I was in nursing school, we also would go to a community center. This is part of our community health and nursing. And we would do blood pressure screenings or diabetes screenings. You could actually do finger sticks on people. I was wondering, do you know of any food pantries that offer any of those services?
Andy, you're hired.
I would love to. I mean, I can even recruit where I'm at.
Yes.
And I'd have to, it's something I'd probably have to check with the state and just make sure that I don't see why I'm a licensed nurse. So there's no reason why I can't take somebody's blood pressure. I mean, you can get yours done at CVS.
Right.
So, but I mean, that's something I'd be more than happy to do if you have. And it was funny because when I was in nursing school, I was like, nobody's going to come to this. Like, who's going to come get their blood pressure checked?
Lots.
We had a line of people coming in and they were so happy to get. So, and, you know, oftentimes people don't think much of that, but honestly, like if you're someone who has hypertension and a history of stroke or heart disease, and it's been a month and a half since you saw your doctor and you come in and your blood pressure is now, you know, 50 points systolically, that top number above where it should be, it's good to know. Maybe you need your medication adjusted. Maybe you're not taking your meds.
It's the food pantries, like schools, are one of the best places to offer intervention and healthcare. So think about how successful we were during COVID using local schools as a place to vaccinate, right? And in the same way, food pantries are so successful with that. So in the past, we have had some really great things. We definitely had WIC even sign, you know, have a table where we signed up people. One of the things that has become really complicated about our food pantry is how we reach our clientele. So in the beginning, our clientele used to be able to shop, which gave them a real level of independence and choice and autonomy. But what happened is we went from 80 clients in a year to the next year serving 200 to recently in the last year topping at 300. And so when you have 300 people that you need to serve in 2 hours, it's a fast track system. Yeah. But we do have smaller kind of places where this can happen. When vets come to pick up their food boxes. When we have a group of elderly folks who come here. We call them our neighborhood ladies that we love. That would be a great place. And food pantries really are that community hub, that community center where these things can happen.
Do you know if Rose's or if any other of the food pantries, if they also, you often have people who are shut in, you know, we used to call them shut-ins. I'm not sure what the
Yeah, term now is the that. Term is homebound. We used to call them shut-ins homebound. Too, but right, now yeah. homebound, yes, correct?
I'm antiquated, my terminology.
All of my terminology is antiquated.
And oftentimes these people will get like Meals on Wheels or other programs like that, but that's, you know, a couple, what was it, you know, two meals a day, something.
Yeah, I actually think it's more like five meals just a week.
A week, yeah. So do you know of any of the food pantries that know of any of these people and will actually deliver food to
us?
Them?
Us.
Okay.
Us, because we're the best. So that's one of the populations that we identify that really needs help. And so we partner with an organization called Ethos, which is a Boston program that is really in service to the elders in our community. And so we partner with Ethos, and a social worker or a community worker at Ethos will recommend people to us, and then we will deliver that food to them. The other thing that happens is we're happy for anybody to just suggest and say to us, I think my neighbor needs help. I don't know if they have the financial ability or not, but they're not getting out of their house. That's all we need to hear. We're not going to do a financial back check to find out if somebody needs food or not. Recently, college students are a new growing group of food insecure people. A college professor here in our community let me know that they had a food insecure student. We didn't need to know anything else. We packed them a box. And can I go ahead and shame MIT? You know that incredible institution that has tremendous amounts of food?
Yeah.
They have food insecure, a significant food insecure population on their campus. And so we work with an MIT chaplain, and we give her food to feed these students and bring to them.
Which is also another group that, and I think that some people would be like, well, college students, yeah, like starving college students living on ramen and whatnot. Like a lot of people did that, that's fine. But there is a difference when literally like you just don't have money to buy healthy food. And most schools, you know, provide to some level, but at the same time, I have a niece who's a freshman right now. And it's like, I'm sure if she wanted to, she could probably eat what's in the cafeteria, but half the time she doesn't for one reason or another. And I don't know what her reasoning is, but... At the same time, yeah, it's an interesting population that you might not normally think who don't have access just to healthy food.
Or they're not buying the meal plan because it's expensive and they're cutting that out. Yeah. One of the things that was great about the graduate school I went to is they had this enormous bread table outside of where you bought your food. And they had this enormous bread table, and there was always peanut butter and jelly there. And you could buy a bowl of soup for $2. So I always remember thinking, do they know what they're doing? I think they know what they're doing. I hope they know what they're doing. Because pretty much you could go to graduate school and not get on the meal plan and save a bunch of money and just keep on buying $2 bowls of soup. And you could live on that bread and that peanut butter and that jelly and that soup. And it was pretty fantastic. And all college campuses should have just food out. There should just be baskets of apples and oranges and bananas everywhere. I'm sorry, absolutely. MIT. Sorry. Hope you listen to this podcast. You can afford it.
Yeah. Tuition right now it's been rising for the last, you know, 40 years. There's absolutely no excuse why they can't provide decent food for free. And it's, yeah, when you look at the breakdown, and you know this, your husband is a college professor. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he could get his hand on how much it costs. When you're signing up for your tuition, how much of that is actually like your room and board and meal plan?
Yes.
It's absolutely astronomical.
Yes.
And there's no way that they're spending, that each student is worth that
nope.
much per year. So
nope.
It's just another way that universities, and that I'll stay off my soapbox, but.
Yeah. No, but they should be balancing that, right? They should be thinking about students who are in a potential food insecurity demographic, right? According to where they live or if they're parents are single or a vet or any of these things that we've just talked about, immigrants, and then they should think, we're going to put them on a free meal plan. We do that at schools.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't we do it? I mean, at public schools, why wouldn't we do that at college?
And a well-nourished student is going to perform better than a non-well-nourished
student. So if you got to be kidding me. You mean hungry children don't learn as well as children with full bellies?
Hungry adults don't either.
No, they don't.
It's very common. And I guess, yeah, to your point, I'm thinking about also college students that are on college campuses. But there are a lot of I never lived in a dorm when I went to college. I was always working and living on my own. And I had no money. Like I probably would have qualified as food insecure because there were a lot of, you know, Taco Bell runs because it was like $1 for $2 you could eat.
Yep.
You know, or there were, you know, bagels or just something very simple. So that's something that just kind of, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, college students aren't all on in dorms either.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can I circle back to the immigrant population?
Let's actually talk a little bit about, because when you were talking about populations most affected, like we touched on, you know, children and seniors. But immigrants, especially like in this area in Boston right now, we've seen a huge influx, especially, you know, in Caribbean nations. So Haiti, the Dominican, we've seen a huge influx over the last couple of years, which I don't blame them at all. Like it's Haiti's such a, you know, war-torn place right now. It's not a place to live.
No.
Yeah, please, if you want to expand
a
little more.
So one of the things that I want to say that is so important is food pantries that are connected to a larger food pantry. So we're connected to the Greater Boston Food Pantry. We have to collect information. And that information that we collect is so important. It helps us understand who is in the demographic that's facing food insecurity. And that's really important information for our government. So to be a part of the Greater Boston Food Pantry, we have to find out where people live, if they have children in their homes, vets, elderly, all of that stuff. But when we collect that information doesn't go to some government website that then, you know, figures out if that person is documented or not. And we've worked really hard at this food pantry making that clear. Trying to say again and again to our immigrant populations that this is why we have this information. We're not giving this information out to anyone. You are safe here with us. We care about you. If you are in this country, documented or undocumented, you have a right to food. And that is so important because sadly, I can't tell you how many times I hear from the naysayers. Well, they don't speak English. They don't belong here anyhow. Why are they eating our resources? But nobody ever asks us why we're gobbling up most of the resources in the world as a rich country. We have more than enough food. We do not have a lack of food in America. We have a lack of access to healthy food in America. We have enough to feed everyone. And that's significantly important. And I just want you to know that no food pantry, I can't imagine any food pantry participating or getting in bed with ICE. That's not what we do. We are not here to figure out if you are in this country as a documented citizen or an undocumented citizen. You are here and you matter, and we want to make sure you're fed.
Which is, like you said, the founding principle, you know, kind of you know, not only your church, but a lot of just the, you know, the Protestant way, food is love.
Food is love. Food is love.
And I think that's something that's relatable across, you know, any nationality, no matter where you live or where you're from. And it's also something that I've seen, especially in this area, it's something that's highly relatable, no matter if you speak the language or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that good food is
it's
good
fun.
Food.
Like, yes.
Food doesn't know language.
It's really fun. And I mean, thinking about your profession, right, Andy? You don't ask a person who comes to a critical care unit, do you speak English? Because only if you speak English can I serve you. Do you have your citizen papers? That's not who we are.
That's not why I'm there. You know?
Right. No. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows this is not how we collect information for ICE. That is not what this is about. It's really so that the larger government entity, so that they can do a good job making sure that we're getting food to where it needs to go.
Yeah. With regard to funding, so I know that federally you probably get some funding. I imagine the state also, and probably even the city. I know you're part of the Greater Boston
Yes.
Food Bank, and you're part of a larger food bank. Do you know where most of your funding comes from? How much is it donation from?
Uh-oh, Andy's asking me percentages and numbers.
It's not, it's a huge... I'm just curious, like, if you...
It's a huge combination.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, right? So we don't get any federal funding per se because... The Greater Boston Food Bank is what is federally funded, and we are a direct recipient of those incredible grants. We did, in some ways, get federal funding during the COVID relief work. Mm-hmm. We get a bunch of grants. Sometimes the grants are infrastructure that are really helpful. Like, we needed better, just technological equipment, which we got. That was a great grant to have iPads that we register people on. But we get a combination. And one of the things that I've been in, you know, the fundraising business for a long time, if you're a pastor, you have to fundraise if you like it or not so you can stay open. It is so easy to tell the story of why you need to give to a food pantry. People just open their wallets. And I can't tell you how many people just show up at our doors and just give us checks. And the checks range from, you know, $25 to thousands. And it's amazing. And of course we have to fundraise. And of course we have to think about how much money we have. Because if we have enough money, we can buy diapers. Diapers are expensive.
Yeah.
Right? But on the flip side, it's not hard. And that makes me really proud of our community, that people are always willing to give to a food pantry.
Which is fantastic, especially, you know, these days with food costs being so high. Over the last, I think, 4 years, food costs have increased by more than 25%, or right around there. And then fuel costs, home heating, all of that is skyrocketed, which just contributes more. People need to pay their bills, and so they cut down on how much food.
Mm-hmm.
Just, it's a mess.
Yes.
With regard to veterans, so you were saying that, so Rose's Bounty specifically has, is it, one day a week? How often?
So it's kind of amazing. So people who don't know Boston, we are about a mile and a half from the VA hospital in Boston, which is one of the oldest and the kind of flagship VA hospitals in America. It's a pretty amazing place. And so because we're so close, it seemed like an obvious choice. And so we partner with the social workers at the VA. And so there are some, it all depends on the veteran, right? Some have transitioned out of shelters and now have homes. Sometimes just small apartments, doesn't really matter. And so those folks, as they get back on their feet, they need food deliveries every week. And so they get food deliveries every week. So we call that our regular vet pack that we do on Fridays. But once a month, we have the huge vet pack. And that could be, let's think, a veteran who is now employed, doing pretty well, but still on the edge. And a box of food delivered to them might mean the difference between paying their heat bill or not, getting discouraged or not, or being reminded somebody cares about me. And that's the other thing I want to say about food. Just think about, it's the holiday season, right? I love to bake Christmas cookies. Not super nutritious. Sorry, Andy. But,
cookies too.
Yes. How great is it when somebody drops off Christmas cookies to your place of work, or your neighbor drops them off? You're reminded that you're cared about. And food, when you're able to give food to somebody, they're an isolated homebound person, or they're an immigrant who's new to the country and has just been living off food at the corner store. Or if they are a vet who's just transitioned into the home and all of a sudden the refrigerator gets filled, man, I think what that food means is you matter.
Definitely. It's funny you mentioned that. My neighbor just dropped off a bag with a couple of cookies yesterday, or 2 days ago. So, and of course, I ate one last night. But
yeah, good.
Yeah, and the wife can't eat them because she has food allergies. So,
oh!
So they're all mine.
Oh, good.
So, you know, it is the holiday season right now, at least here in the United States, and obviously for a large part of the rest of the world. And this year, it's typically a time of generosity here and abroad. Nonprofits this time of year typically receive about 30% of their annual giving. And then donors who actually give for the first time in December they usually give about 50% more than they would any other time of the year. Do you typically see an increase this time of year?
Is it huge? Huge. And here's what I would tell people who'd like to give to their local food pantry. If you want to come up with that amount of money you want to give to your local food pantry and put it in your savings account and give it in February, we would love you forever. Or if you think, gosh, it's the holiday season, I want to do something nice with my family and volunteer, could you come in February? And I really mean this. Yeah. So we get inundated in December with food. We need food in February. Every organization is doing really good work in December. And that sounds terrible. All these grassroots organizations are doing lots of good work all year long. Yeah. But often, if you are food insecure, you're getting a lot of support from a lot of different areas in your life in December, but you're not in February. And especially in a place like Boston, your heat's still on and you're struggling. And February is the time that food pantries are most empty.
Do you think that with monetary, do you think that monetary donations then are probably a little more helpful than actual food donations? Or if somebody is planning to donate a large amount, would it be better for them to kind of just do it incrementally throughout the year? Or
yes. Actually, I say yes to all of these things. So money is always great. And one of the reasons why money is great is just think about it. We can buy so much more tomato sauce for a cheaper price from the Greater Boston Food Pantry than anybody can at their local grocery store. That said, maybe you went out grocery shopping and you got way too much of X. And you're like, and we didn't like this. That's okay. You don't like that tomato sauce. Give it to your local food pantry. Or if you're somebody like me who loves taking your kids when they were little grocery shopping and making them pick out things that they liked so they could give it to the local food pantry, go ahead and do that. There's so many ways to give the food pantry. And I'll give you some highlights. Give low sodium food. Give fun children's name brand cereal. Make a kid's day. Give them name brand cereal, the kind of cereal that your kids might beg you for. Money, yes, always. And however money is given is always gratefully accepted. If you give money every month or if you give one big check, it will be gratefully welcomed. Another idea, ask your local food pantry if they need carts. So if you're in an urban area, those pull carts that people can take home food on is life-changing. So that they can load up a cart with as much food as they can and take it on public transportation. That mother you were talking about with three kids, that is life-altering.
That's something I never even thought about, too. Because we discussed it, just logistically, how you move so much. And you're saying you have the food that you give away each, you know, week here. So how do you get that from point A to point B if you're, you know, a mile or two away and you have no vehicle?
So I have a really touching story. I'm always collecting weird rolly bags that I know could fit a lot of food and people could move. And we have a bunch of carts here that we've invested in, and we have bungee cords and the whole thing. And there was a woman who I am assuming was a very new immigrant, because she's been coming probably for at least 6+ months, and I've watched her English improve. So my guess is she was pretty new to this country. And she came up as a walker, and she was overwhelmed by the food, and she was on a part of the sidewalk with all the food, and she was trying to figure out which way to manage to put it in bags to carry it back on public transportation. You know, and she was making decisions about what food she would take, what they would eat, what was the, you know, most probably in her head, how long will this feed us? And I got one of those crazy bags I have, which is an old duffel bag. It almost looks like a hockey bag on wheels. I gave it to her. She almost wept. Every time she sees me, she shows me the bag and hugs me. I mean, a used bag, Andy, made an enormous difference in someone's life.
It doesn't take much, right?
No, it doesn't take much.
So I guess for anybody looking to volunteer, if you want to help out in this community, you know, like I said, we're in Boston, anywhere else. So for those who are actually seeking to help, if they want to provide either in-person or monetary donations, what's the best way for them to kind of reach out to a local food pantry or even just any kind of charity? If you're in, you know, obviously we're in the Boston area, but say someone is in, I don't know, California, should they just show up where they want to go? Like, what do you think is most helpful?
I think what's most helpful is showing up and saying, I'm here to help. or calling the local food pantry and asking, how can I help? The most unhelpful thing is to come with expectations and tell someone how you want to help. Or my favorite is giving money and saying how it can only be used for X.
Who would do that?
Everyone.
Really?
Okay, not everyone. That was a negative comment.
All right.
But show up with an open heart. Show up ready to do whatever grunt work needs to be done. Like, you know what has to be sometimes done? The refrigerators need to be cleaned out. They need to just be scrubbed down. Sometimes we just have to sit in front of loads of food and check expiration dates. It's not always glorious work, but if you go into these things ready to volunteer with an open heart, it's always fulfilling.
And then for, so with Rose's Bounty, I don't know if you can kind of let anybody, if there's anybody who knows somebody who might need help, if there's anybody who wants to volunteer, for Rose's Bounty specifically here in the West Roxbury of Boston, West Roxbury area of Boston, what days do you guys actually provide?
Second Saturdays and first Fridays. My food pantry director is going to fire me, although she's not my boss. I'm not her boss. Second Saturdays and the Friday that follows that second Saturday.
Okay.
And you should definitely look on our website, rosesbounty.org, and you can learn more. And what you really need to do is you need to show up with documentation of where you live.
Is that, that's all you need?
That's all you need. Right. It could be a passport with, you know, you bring your local heat bill, shows where you live, and we'll help you out.
Excellent. It's so great. I mean, it's a service that I don't think a lot of people realize happens, you know, all throughout the country every week, helping to provide for people. And like I said, the numbers are pretty staggering just for those who are food insecure. And the fact there are so many children that are affected as well, and seniors who we often don't think about. And especially with our baby boomers now reaching that critical age where it's about to become, far, far, far more, I don't even know how to put this, I guess, one, healthcare in general for our baby boomers is going to be absolutely insane. And then just their needs in general as they get older and can't care for themselves. Food is going to be a huge issue.
Food is going to be a huge issue. And my other thing that I would say is pay attention in your neighborhood. Maybe you have a single parent in your neighborhood. Maybe you have an elderly person in your neighborhood. Go check on them. Or if you're concerned that they would feel embarrassed, go drop off a meal. You wouldn't believe what that would do. Or if they're not embarrassed and you feel like you have that sort of relationship with them, maybe even find out the information about where your local food pantry is and offer to drive them. It's a big deal.
Well, Abby, thank you so much. It is the holiday season. It is Christmas time here in West Roxbury. So I guess before we leave, a couple of questions. Do you watch Christmas movies?
Yes.
What's your favorite Christmas movie?
Angela's Christmas.
I have never heard of it.
Oh, you have to watch it. It's animated.
All right.
It's the author who wrote, Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes. It's a short story that he wrote that they animated, and it's magnificent. Angela's Christmas.
All right. And do you have a favorite Christmas song?
Oh, like every carol ever written. Come thou long expected Jesus. Oh, I love Christmas carols. All I listen to. Yes,
excellent.
All of them.
And then last but not least, are you an eggnog person?
Yes, except for it's not nutritious food, and I'm 48, and my waistline has been expanding rapidly. But before that happened and the Christmas season came, my mother would buy me gallons of it.
Oh. I have to have it in small doses. I have, over the years, because the wife doesn't do dairy, I don't do dairy. So now when I have anything with dairy, it comes with 2 lactaid pills or else I'm like suffering.
Oh, no, I'm not suffering.
So
I love me some eggnog.
Well, Abby, thank you so much. For all my listeners, anybody, like I said, who is looking to donate to your local food pantry or, you know, any charitable organization this time of year, please do so. Try to help those in need. We at the podcast, for every download of the podcast that we get, we will match $1 for that and donate that to Rose's Bounty. beyond that, anybody, if you have any questions, requests, comments, we are on X at Make Me Sick Pod, and then we can also be reached via email at makemesickpod@gmail.com. Abby, thank you again very much.
Thank you, Andy.
Have a very
it's an honor
Merry
to be
Christmas.
On.
Yeah. And I will see you this Sunday.
You better see me this Sunday.
Full disclosure, Abby is also my pastor. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. And remember to always wash your hands.
Snowflakes fall on a silent night. Roses bounty shine so bright. Pastor Abby and her caring crew, spreading kindness, it's what they do. Empty shelves, they fill with love. Hands that help fit like a glove. Volunteers in coats so worn, change the world in every storm. Is clear. Ooh. Boxes packed with meals to share. Lights of hope, they're everywhere. In the church where love abounds, food and comfort knows no bounds. Children smile, their tummies full, thanks to efforts so wonderful. Roses bounty leads the way, in every heart its warmth will stay. Oh, the spirit of Christmas here we find, in hearts so giving and people kind. Fighting hunger and spreading cheer, with Pastor Abby the answer's clear. Clear.